now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. For 9 years, South Carolina officials struggled to identify the boy in the woods, a young man whose body had been discovered just south of Myrtle Beach in a fishing village called Morrell's Inlet. Meanwhile, 1,200 miles away in Kansas City, Missouri, Frank McGonigal's family searched for him at Grateful Dead concerts and in the face of every long-haired hitchhiker they passed. Consumed by guilt by how they treated him, Frank's 8 siblings came to understand that, like Jerry Garcia sang, he's gone and nothing's going to bring him back. Frank McGonigal was finally found and identified as the boy in the woods. 4 years later, the case still unsolved. Jim Cosgrove, a McGonigal family friend and investigative journalist, picked up the trail of Frank's cold case and began uncovering connections to a ruthless local crime boss and blunders by the threadbare sheriff's department. When his research began to stall, a chance meeting with the soft-hearted, straight-talking energy reader Carol Williams provided a metaphysical spark that reignited Jim's resolve. Although his work as a journalist trained him to be skeptical, Cosgrove found himself starting to become a believer when Carol provided details about Frank's murder that turned out to be freakishly accurate. In 2019, Cosgrove returned to Morrell's Inlet with one of Frank's brothers to dredge up old leads and settle Frank's case once and for all. The book that we're featuring this evening is Ripple, A Long, Strange Search for a Killer, with my special guest and guest of investigative author and journalist and narrator, Jim Cosgrove. Welcome to the program and thank you so much for this interview, Jim Cosgrove.
Thank you, Dan. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. This is a incredible tale, as I was mentioning just before. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, yeah. I love to talk about it.
Let's talk about how you got this start. You say that this book has its start in St. Peter's Catholic Church in Kansas City, Missouri, in the fall of 1994. Who were you? We mentioned in the introduction about you being a journalist. Tell us where you were professionally and your connection to this Frank McGonigal and the family and how this book got started in the fall of 1994.
Yes, you bet. Well, I grew up in Kansas City, and Frank was the middle child of another large Irish Catholic family in our neighborhood. And in our neighborhood, it seemed everybody was Irish Catholic or Jewish. That's just the way it ended up in our neighborhood. And we all belonged to the Jewish Community Center. And we had kind of an idyllic community there where everybody knew each other and everybody seemingly, at least on the surface, got along. And their family was close with my family. Our parents were friends, and many of my siblings were in school with many of the McGonigal siblings. But by the fall of 1994, I had moved, and I was living in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and I was writing for the Albuquerque Journal at the time. And I happened to be home back in Kansas City for a vacation, or just to see my mother. And she asked me to take her to Mass at St. Peter's Church. So I did. It was a midday Mass. And as we were coming out, there in the courtyard is a statue of St. Francis of Assisi. And I looked at the plaque, and it was dedicated to Frank McGonigal. And I said, oh, yeah, Frank, I remember when he disappeared. He disappeared when I was in high school. And I said, you know what? And I knew that there had been, some resolution as far as the family at least finding out kind of what happened to him. And I said, you know, whatever came of that? And she kind of filled me in on it and had got my wheels turning. And I thought, you know, that would make a great story. And I asked her, do you think the McGonigals would talk to me? And she said, sure, they're very open about it. And so I approached the McGonigals with the intention of actually just doing a story about their journey and what they went through. 9 years, they searched for Frank. They didn't know what had happened to him.
Right.
So I kind of wanted to just focus on that. And I needed a subject for a master's thesis for, I was getting a master's degree while I was working at the newspaper. And I thought, hey, this would be a perfect subject.
So you decided to use this as your master's thesis. And first thing, you had to get cooperation from the McGonagall family and do the necessary interviews. Tell us about that.
Yes. So, I approached them. The McGonagalls are very well known in Kansas City. Bill McGonagall opened a meat market in 1950. And everybody, at least on the south side of Kansas City, knew the McGonagalls. They had the best meat in town, and you went there to get your briskets and your right. turkeys at Thanksgiving, and they had such a large family that everybody kind of knew someone who knew a McGonagall, and so they were locally well known and great people, very very generous, and they helped out people in the neighborhood who would fall on hard times. And so they were well-loved as well. So I approached them and said, hey, I'd like to do this story, and I would like, to just find out kind of what you went through. And so I arranged interviews not only with Bill and Joan McGonagall, the parents, but every one of Frank's siblings. And over the next several months, I was able to do that and write my thesis. Now, Mrs. McGonagall, Joan, asked me at the time to not publish it as a book. She said, we get into too many family, family secrets, and it's a difficult subject. And as a mother of a large family, that was her life's work. And right. And any mother would understand that. And so I said, sure, I will just use this as my master's thesis, and I won't, publish anything. Well, many years later, well, I guess it would have been almost 10 years later, my wife and I were at a brunch with my mother and some of her friends, and Joan McGonagall was there. And she pulled me aside. She said, hey, Jim, I've been thinking about, the story you did about Frank. And she said, if you want to publish it, go ahead. I give you my blessing. And I said, okay. But at the time, I was newly married. We had a child on the way, a lot of other things going on. So I kind of shelved it for a while. And it took me then another 10 years before I got on it.
Tell us the story of what happens. And you mentioned that you talked to all the siblings, Frank's siblings. We, in the introduction, talked about some of the guilt. What was this guilt that they had and how they treated him? What was Frank like? And before we talk about what happened and his decision to leave home.
Yes. Well, so coming from a large family myself, everything I learned from the McGonagalls was very familiar.
Right.
I didn't hear anything that hadn't happened in our own family.
Right.
They were, the McGonagalls are very energetic, boisterous, opinionated, fun, loving family. They very much like ours, religious, loud Irish Catholic family. And Frank was really not so much like that. He was a gentle soul. He was a little bit more introverted and quiet. He was a trusting soul, and he just never quite kind of fit in, I guess. And his siblings would talk about how he just, he would keep to himself, and then he struggled with depression. And he, of course, at the time, like a lot of young kids at that time, he just experimented with drugs. And
sure.
he was, as I interviewed his psychologist later on, he said Frank was almost too gentle for this world, too trusting for this world. And so he struggled to find his place in the family. And I tell people, all of us know somebody like Frank.
Mm-hmm.
Frank was, whether it's a brother or a cousin or a friend, we see Frank or ourselves in Frank.
Yeah.
He was just trying to find himself, and he struggled. And he was in school, college for like 6 years and never graduated. At the time he left home, he was 26 years old, and he had moved back into his family home, was working at the family market, the meat market and grocery. And, any 26-year-old at that point is like, he wants to get out. He wants to you know, find him, you know, make his own way in the world. But he struggled a lot, and his family had a hard time. His siblings really trying to help him. They wanted to help, but they couldn't figure it out. And so when he left, they felt a lot of guilt, like maybe they had not done everything they could to prevent him from leaving.
He was close with his siblings, and he worked with his brother. Can we talk about what was said between the brothers and the circumstances surrounding that?
Yes. The youngest four are boys, and they were known as the boys. And they have an older brother, too, who was amongst the sisters. But the boys were tight, and they spent a lot of time together. They were always having a game of hockey, or they played, just broomstick hockey on their patio. They were playing football. They would play foosball in the basement. Anyway, they spent a lot of time together. And really, Frank's best friends were his brothers. The two of them went away to college, and his youngest brother, Mike, was still at home when Frank was 26. And yeah, all the kids at one point or the other worked at the store. And so at the time, Frank and Mike were working at the store. They had recently taken a long trip to California together, and they got back. And one of their tasks at the store was to clean it. And they had a process for stripping the floors and waxing them, periodically. So this weekend, on a Sunday when the store was closed, they went out to wax the floor, and they got in a silly argument about how to do it. Frank was like, this is the way you do it. And Mike, the youngest, was saying, no, this isn't how you do it. You're messed up. And anyway, they got in this argument. And the final words that Mike said to his brother were, Frank, why don't you fuck off and die?
Yeah.
And he stormed out of the store and left. And those were the last words that his brother Mike said to Frank. And as Mike said, he said, you know, it took me 5 years of intense therapy to get over that guilt. And Frank left the next day, and he never saw him again.
Now, what we're talking about, music and everybody's love in this family of the same band. Tell us about the band. And, well, we alluded to it in the introduction,
yes,
but tell us about their love of the band. And this is a band that many, many people are dedicated to following. So tell us.
Yes. So the boys in particular in that family, big fans of the Grateful Dead, and they had all been to many shows. In fact, their trip to California was kind of as I think in the book, I refer to it as kind of a trip to Mecca for our deadheads. They went to Berkeley to see the Dead, and they had planned this road trip, and they all went out there, or Frank and Mike went out there and met some of his siblings out there. And it was a bond that they had through this music, and of course the experiences of going to the shows. So when he disappeared, my big assumption was, hey, he's out following the Dead. So one of the things they started to do was they started going to Dead shows and to see if they could find Frank among the people who kind of that community that follows them from town to town. And Frank liked to hitchhike, so they looked for him in hitchhikers along the side of the road. They looked in newspapers from around the country just to see if there were any news stories about someone who was, you know, anything from, injured in an accident or had amnesia and didn't know who he was. And, you know, they were looking at any possible leads that they could get. But yeah, the Grateful Dead, definitely they had a real strong bond over the music.
Tell us of the last day with the family and when he leaves. And then what is the response from the parents, Joan and Bill, and the police?
Yeah, so that the day after Mike and Frank had their argument at the grocery store, by the time Frank got up out of bed the next day, this was a Monday, the boys were out and already at work. And so he was kind of at home. The only other person home was his mother. And he came out, and his mother had a little argument about just keeping the place clean. She said, hey, you know, can you kind of keep this place cleaned up? And he got in a little argument with her. And then Joan, his mother, had to leave and run some errands. So he then is when he left. And I don't know if he had made the decision. Some of his siblings speculated that he'd already made the decision the day before to leave or that morning. But somewhere in there, he drove to the bank a few blocks from their house, withdrew all of his money. He had $3,800 in his account. He took it all in cash. He had asked the teller to convert part of it into traveler's checks, but they couldn't because the bank officer at the time who handled that wasn't there. So he took it all in cash. He immediately peeled part of it off, put it in a sock because he carried, that's where he carried his cash. He always carried a lot of cash in his sock. And he left. And when his, you know, family, that later that day when he didn't come home, most of them didn't really even think about much about it. They thought, oh, well, right. Frank's gone again. I mean, and he was not, it was not uncommon for him to take off for a day or two and either go camping or just go on an adventure somewhere. And, but his parents knew he always called. He always let them know where he was. And so a day went by and they didn't hear from him. So they thought, okay, in a couple days, when a couple days went by, they started to get a little concerned, right? That, you know, we would have heard from him by now. And so then when, you know, a handful of days went by, they did approach the Kansas City Police Department, who of course said, well, there's not much we can do. He's an adult. There was no foul play or anything, or and he left in his own car, and there's not much we can do. So they then had to kind of rally their community. And, you know, so again, like I said, we grew up in this big Irish Catholic community. Everybody knows everybody. So people, mobilized and contacted friends in other cities. And they most of them suspected he headed west because he loved the West. And so they hadn't really considered that he went east, but he, in fact, you know, that's where he was. And it was just 5 days after he left home that he was murdered.
You write that June 14th, 1982, Nance's Oyster Roast, a restaurant, there's a report of a dead body.
Yes.
What happens? This is a Deputy Hyman right. Makes a call, South Carolina.
So now we move to the coast of South Carolina. So Merle's Inlet is a little fishing village just south of Myrtle Beach, north of Georgetown, which is an historic town and the county seat there. And so, yes, a call comes in from Nance's Oyster Roast, which is a well-known local family seafood restaurant. And they said, they found a body in the woods. Can you come and check it out? So Deputy Hyman shows up and there are two local boys sitting there and he knows these guys. One of whom in particular is a guy who has a lot of history with the local sheriff's department. Mm-hmm. He is a local troublemaker. His name's Tommy McDowell, and everybody in town, when I went down there first and started asking questions, everybody in town knew Tommy McDowell. Oh yeah, Tommy McDowell. They all had a story about him, and he was known for stealing stuff, maybe setting some fires, you know, stirring up trouble, shooting off guns just for fun, and generally just stirring things up. And so he was there, and his cousin, Chris Nance, younger cousin, was also there. And they reported to the deputy that they had been out playing in the woods, riding their bikes through the woods, and had stepped off the path, and they found this body up, propped up against a tree. So they went back to to Nance's restaurant and called the sheriff's department to come up. And so there were two part-time deputies who patrolled Merle's Inlet at that time. And And Merle's Inlet is an interesting place. It's on the coast and it's got a history of, you know, piracy through and the bootleg liquor through prohibition and running drugs in the 60s and 70s. But also, to make things more complicated, there's a county line that runs through literally the north side of town. Part of Merle's Inlet is in another county, and part of it is it's an unincorporated, but you know, part of it, so it straddles a county line. So the jurisdiction over which sheriff is responsible for it is often toss up. So this fell to Georgetown County on the south side. And Deputy Hyman, then took these two boys to the woods where they showed him where this body was. And from then on, he was known as the boy in the woods.
Now, the thing is there's no, this is many miles away from where Frank McGonigal is and where the police are not even looking for him, but the family is. And you say that the family employs everybody that they know in their church, and there's masses being said, and every effort to make flyers and get the word out.
Yes.
How do you get involved in this and basically investigate this case?
Right. So at the time that he was missing, all of us in the neighborhood, you know, knew that he was missing. And like a lot of things, you know, as it got longer and longer, you know, and it became clearer that something had happened to him. But then also, as time goes by, you move on, right? I then went to college and then, you know, and then graduated from college. And, you know, so I kind of lost track of what was going on until that moment with my mother. And we saw the statue and she reminded me what was going on. So that sparked my interest. When I got involved with the McGonagalls and started to interview them, what really piqued my interest was Merle's Inlet, this little town. And, you know, that they had a suspect, but they just were never able to, you know, pin it on anybody. It was one of these deals where everybody in town was convinced that Tommy McDowell committed this crime, but they never had any evidence to pin it on him. It was just circumstantial. So I thought, hey, in order to do this story well, I need to go there. So I then, in the February of 1995, I went to Merle's. I actually went to Georgetown, and where the county seat is in the sheriff's department, and checked into a bed and breakfast there and started poking around and just started. The sheriff's department was very helpful. They let me, you know, look at the file that they had. It was pretty skimpy file. It was just basically a handwritten police report, a couple of Polaroid photos of the crime scene, and just a few other items in there, a few other documents. And so I just started poking around and talking to people and talking to locals. And my gut instinct was, yeah, everybody in town said, oh, Tommy McDowell, he was a mess and he was trouble. But my gut told me that it wasn't, that Tommy did not do this. What struck me about Tommy was that all of the crimes that he had been taken in on, you know, as a minor, because this was all before he was 18, they were breaking and entering and then, you know, writing checks on somebody else's checking account. And they were, but they were not violent. There was nothing in there that, and my gut told me, I don't know that this guy would have the guts enough or the penchant to kill somebody. It just didn't seem to add up for some reason.
When did you first speak to Chris? Because Chris is such an important person in this story.
Yes.
Talk about Chris and who his father is. And that Tommy is a cousin of Chris.
Yes.
So tell us a little bit more about this.
So Chris was one of the two. So Chris and Tommy found the body, Frank's body in the woods. And Tommy was 4 years older than Chris. They grew up together. Tommy was like his older brother and corrupted him like an older sibling might. He was often, and Chris was often involved in some of the things that Tommy was involved in. And they kind of ran together, and Chris's father ran Nance's Oyster Roast, the local restaurant, and very well-known family establishment. And not unlike the McGonagalls, they were well-known in their community. But Paul Nance, Chris's father, was also well-known for some other things. He was the biggest drug dealer importer and dealer along the coast there. So as I mentioned before, Merle's Inlet is an inlet from the sea. There's kind of an inlet from the ocean, and it has served for centuries, has served as a protection from the sea. Sailors would often duck in there to get out of a storm. Pirates were known to hide out in there, and it made a perfect place for drug runners to come in and, you know, boats to come in. And Paul Nance had a fleet of shrimp boats under his thumb. He bought, so he had shrimps and oyster fishermen who would sell to him. And so he was a kind of their go-to guy. Well, at the same time as they were bringing in their haul, they were also bringing in drugs that then he would distribute up and down the coast. And he had an empire, and he was very wealthy, and Everybody in town kowtowed to him, including, as many alluded to, the sheriff's department. Many said that, you know, that the good old boy network, he had the sheriff's department in his back pocket. So he was known for, he was the fixer in town. When anything happened, well, he either was involved in it or became involved in it. And he was feared. You know, Chris Nance, when I first met him, said, you know, he said, he said it was like the local mafia. And he said, as a kid, I couldn't get other kids to play with me because they were all afraid of my dad. And so when I first met Chris, he was rather forthcoming about all this stuff. His dad was dead by that time, and he wanted to kind of set the record straight. Many of his family thought he was rewriting some of the history, but he said, you know, my dad was a drug dealer, and he was involved in a lot of nasty, nefarious stuff. And everybody in town knew about Paul Nance. And so there's some speculation that Paul may have helped Tommy and Chris clean up the crime scene. When they found Frank's body, there was no identification on his body. His car was missing. And it was just him and a sleeping bag and a little ring, a fire ring that was set up in the woods like he was about to start a campfire. All of his possessions were gone. So somehow, someone had to have cleaned up that site, gotten rid of Frank's car, taken his wallet, and any other identifying things. So yeah, when I met Chris in February of 95, he kind of filled me in on the family history.
What I wanted to just mention as well, or ask you about, is that Chris, originally, what Tommy had said is that, or there was some contention that Chris wasn't at the scene, but that Tommy had then gotten him and said, you want to come and see this body?
Oh, yes.
So there was that contention.
When I spoke to Chris, he said he wasn't there when the body was found. And I said, well, according to the police report, you and Tommy were out in the woods and you stumbled upon this body. He said, no. That's not how it happened. And that he was actually at the restaurant and that Tommy came to him and said, hey, I found a body in the woods. Do you want to go see it? And then he went back there with him and a guy that worked at the restaurant. And three of them then went to look at the body, just to see the body. Then they came to report it. So Chris says he wasn't there originally to begin with. And I personally suspect that Chris was somehow not involved in the actual murder, but he said he wasn't even there when they found the body, which is different than the police report. So there are some mixed messages there.
Let's use this as an opportunity, Jim, to stop for a second to hear from our sponsor, which is Nutrafol. 80 million men and women in the U.S. experience thinning hair, yet it's still not openly talked about, which can make going through it feel stressful, and that just adds to the problem. Nutrafol is the number one dermatologist recommended hair growth supplement, clinically shown to improve your hair growth, thickness, and visible scalp coverage for men and women. Did you know that there are multiple causes of thinning hair? Nutrafol is the hair growth supplement that goes beyond genetics to target stress, hormones, nutrition, metabolism, aging, and lifestyle factors that may be impacting your hair. Thinning is different for men and women. Nutrafol has multiple unique formulas for men and women to provide exactly what they need based on their biology and age. Every formula is physician formulated, using natural medical-grade ingredients for reliable results without compromises. In clinical studies, 72% of men saw more scalp coverage, 86% of women saw improved hair growth after 6 months. Nutrafol is also trusted and recommended by more than 3,000 top doctors. You can grow thicker, healthier hair and support our show by going to Nutrafol.com. and entering promo code SHOCKING to save $15 off your first month's subscription. This is their best offer anywhere, and it's only available to U.S. customers for a limited time. Plus free shipping on every order. Get $15 off at Nutrafol.com, spelled N-U-T-R-A-F-O-L.com, promo code shocking. Now, Jim, we had mentioned that this incredible, fateful meeting of someone called an energy reader. He said she's not a psychic.
Right.
A person named Carol Williams, this extraordinary person. Tell us the circumstances in which you meet her and what you eventually team up to do.
Yes. So while I was staying at the bed and breakfast in Georgetown, 20 miles south of Merle's Inlet, it was off season and I was the only one in the place. But one night, two women moved in across the hall from me and we struck up a conversation and we chatted up, ended up going out that night, having some drinks. And one of the women tells me that her friend who was with her is a psychic, an energy reader. She's worked with FBI and police departments and sheriff's departments and to solve crimes. And I said, okay. And I was very skeptical and like, okay, I've heard things like that before. And so the next day we are at late breakfast brunch with the owner of the bed and breakfast. And it's just Carol, the energy reader, and the owner of the bed and breakfast and me. And the owner of the bed and breakfast asks me, hey, Jim, how's your research going? How's your investigation going? And I said, yeah, you know, I've spoken to a lot of people in town. And I said, I get the feeling that, you know, everybody in town thinks Tommy McDowell is the one who killed Frank. And I said, I don't. I get the feeling that someone else is the perpetrator and he is still living here and people are kind of covering for him. And Carol just said, you're right. And I said, okay, what do you mean? I'm right. She said, you're right. There is someone else involved and he is still alive and living here in town. I said, okay, how do you know? She said, I just know. And she said with her just delightful post, she said, honey, you and I met here for a reason.
Yeah.
You know, it was no coincidence that we met this weekend. Mm-hmm. You and I were destined to meet here. And I said, okay, fine. And she said, I'm here to help you. And I said, okay, well, I don't know what your deal is, but would you be willing to come with me to the woods where they found Frank's body and see if you can pick up anything? She said, absolutely. Let's do it. So later that afternoon, we drove up to the woods where they found Frank's body. And we went in. It was a light mist. It was late afternoon and it was a kind of a dreary, misty day. And we're in the woods and it's damp. And she stops and she recreated the entire murder scene for me. She said, I'm picking some things up. I see three guys standing here. And she started identifying people, descriptions, detailed descriptions. One of whom what fit Frank's description perfectly. The other, one of the others was fit the description of Tommy McDowell. And then there was a third guy there described as someone who I had not met. And she recreated what went down. And in her, you know, what she saw, and according to her, was that Frank had asked, these guys had shown him where there was a clearing in the woods where he could camp. And he had asked them if there was a place in town where he could buy some pot. Hey, can I buy some pot around here? And they said, yeah, there's a guy in town that'll sell it to us. And he said, great, let's go. And they said, well, he won't sell it to us if you're with us. So why don't you just give me the money? I'll go into town.
Right.
And get it. And so Frank peels off a $20 bill from the money he's carrying in his sock. And the one who fit the description of Tommy McDowell leaves then to go buy the pot. And according to Carol, while he's gone, the other person saw the money in Frank's sock, pulled out a little 25 caliber pistol and said, hey, give me your money. And Frank laughed at him and said, I'm not going to do that. And the guy fired a shot that grazed his temple,
mm-hmm.
and then shot him a second time. And it went, and yeah, shot him in the eye and killed him instantly. And then when the other guy came back with the legitimately had gone to buy the pot, came back, it was like, what the hell happened here? You know? And the other guy laughed. Oh, you should have seen his face when I shot him. And he's like, whoa, this isn't right. We got to clean this up. And so again, this is all what Carol saw. And they go and get somebody else who comes with another car. They clean up the site. And then she said they drive his car north. Or they drove both cars north. And they had eventually found Frank's car a couple months after he left home. They found it abandoned in a housing project in Wilmington, North Carolina, which is just across the border from South Carolina. And so Carol gave me like incredible details about what went down. She also got into Frank's psyche and head at the time. Like when Frank realized that he was dead, he was very upset because he had had arguments before he left home, a fight with his mother or his brother. And Carol would not have known any of this. She didn't know the McGonagalls. She was lived in North Carolina at the time. And I was from Kansas City. There's no way she would have known any of that. And that he wanted to let his family know that he loved him very much and how sorry he was that he had left home in that state. And she described for me in incredible detail the guy who pulled the trigger. So over the next couple of days, that's what Carol saw in the woods. And so over the next couple of days, I had a list of people I was still looking for. And one of the guys I was looking for was a friend of Tommy's and Chris's, and he was on the list. And I went to track him down, and he was shucking oysters in an oyster shack down by the water.
Right.
And when I knocked on the door, he turned around and looked at me, and it was exactly the guy that fit the description of the guy that Carol said had killed Frank.
Incredible. Yes.
Yeah. So she said, she had hair color. He had dirty kind of blonde hair, dishwater blonde. He had, his teeth were gnarled. But she said the main thing about him was his eyes. She said he had tan eyes. They were the color of creamed coffee.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, okay, that's odd. I've never seen tan eyes before. But when he turned around and looked at me, he had a cigarette dangling out of his mouth, and he had tan eyes. I'm like, oh my God, this is the guy that Carol said killed Frank. And so I was kind of flustered, and I just said, hey, I'm in town working on the story about the boy in the woods. Oh, the boy in the woods. Everybody knew the boy in the woods. And I don't know anything about it. And I said, well, tell me about the town. Tell me about what Merle's Inlet was like at the town. I said, I heard it was crazy. I heard there's lots of stuff going on. You know, people getting cut up with chainsaws and thrown to the alligators. I mean, drug deals gone wrong. And he said, he gave me the best line that anybody there had given me. The best. He said, we've been known to raise a little hell around here. And then he looked me up and down.
Yeah.
I'm this college journalist boy. And he gives me a look from toe up to my head. And he said, but our idea, I said, I imagine our idea of raising hell's a little bit different than yours.
Yeah.
I said,
great line.
Yeah, I think so.
The other thing that Carol had said that we didn't mention was, and very profound, was she even had a name. She mentioned the name Paul, but more importantly, and this is a very vivid, profound scene in this book, where you go to the trailer looking for this Jeff McKenzie.
Yes.
And what Carol had told you was so specific. Like, again, she identified this person. So when you looked at him, it was, these are these telltale signs. Yeah. It was extraordinary. You know,
yes.
You say this was a rush for you to be happening, occurring. But at the same time, she said something about a specific boat. Tell us about this scene when you discover and get verification of that.
Yeah. So she just, she threw out whatever she saw. She's like, I also see a boat. It's not in the water. It's got a name on the back, Missy Ann or Miss Anna or something like that. And she said, I don't know what it means. Well, yeah. So, and she threw out some possible names too. And Paul was on that list. Like she said, I hear the name Paul. There were a couple other names now that I'm blanking. But yeah, so the next couple of days I was out driving around Merle's Inlet. I was looking for the home of Jeff McKenzie, who was on my list. And I turned down one of these gravel roads, And I noticed as I'm driving down the road, there's a lot with a chain link fence around it, and there were several boats parked in there as just a storage place for boats and things. And there on the lot was this boat with the name on the back, Miss Anna or Missy Ann or who. And I thought, whoa, that's what Carol. The boat that Carol. And it was up on blocks. It was had a for sale sign on it. It was. And I thought, oh, that's odd. And then right across the street, or right across the road, there was the home. There was actually a house and a trailer on the same property where Jeff McKenzie lived. And so, I went up to the door and spoke to his father. And his dad told me he was shucking oysters down by the water. So that's how I ended up getting there. But yeah, so that, you know, she told me details about the McGonagall family, details about, you know, about the, you know, the local characters there in Merle's Inlet. And it was truly amazing what she made me a believer. I mean, I was like, wow, all this stuff is just come true.
Absolutely. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these commercial messages. Now, you talked about Carol, and of course, now you want to inform the family of yes. what you found in this investigation, and you're hope that they'll believe you, just like yes. you believe Carol. So tell us about that, and then about the plan for this next trip to include one of the family members.
Yes. Yeah. So Frank's youngest brother, Mike, was my main contact with the McGonagall family. I spoke to everyone, interviewed everybody, but he was my main contact. And
right.
after all this happened with, you know, Carol took me to the woods and told me, oh, and she also, one of the things was that the guy who killed Frank also has something of his. It's a box of some mm-hmm. sort. I see a box. It's a boom box. This guy has Frank's boom box. And I was like, okay, that's an odd detail, but okay. So after all this, when I met, you know, Jeff McKenzie and was freaked out that maybe this was the guy who killed Frank. And yeah. So I went back to the bed and breakfast and I called Mike and I told him everything. And he was sobbing on the phone, just like, oh my God, this is exactly how I had kind of envisioned it going down. And he said, you know, I don't know if it makes any difference, but Frank had my boombox with him when he left mm-hmm. home, you know, and it was in the car and I was upset about it. He took off with my property and he said, I don't know if it makes any difference, but he said my social security number is engraved in the back of the boombox.
Right.
Which was a common practice when you moved into the dorms at that time, they would engrave your social security number and everything you owned in case it was stolen. So, I presented that back to the detective who had been working on the case with the sheriff's department. And, you know, and he said, doesn't mean anything. He could have found it on the side of the road or he could have bought it even if this guy still has it, it's not evidence against him.
Sure.
I wanted to share this information with the family. When I went back to Kansas City, I had recorded everything that Carol said in the woods. When we were in the woods, I had my tape recorder going. So I transcribed the entire conversation with her because some of it's difficult to hear. And when I got back to Kansas City, got together with Joan and Bill McGonagall and the siblings who live there, I played the tape, the recording for them, and they read along the transcription. And it really, for me, was one of the most intense and poignant moments of my life to bring information to a family who had been grieving for all those years and all the loose ends and the unknowns, and to come in and say, hey, this is what I found out. I don't know if it's crazy. I don't know if you're going to think it's crazy, but this is what I found out. And it was so cathartic for everybody, but it, you know, of course there were tears and almost to the person, every one of his siblings said, that doesn't surprise me at all. That makes perfect sense about how this, it would have been just like Frank too, to go into this town and say, hey, can meet some strangers. Hey, can you show me a place to, you know, to camp? Yeah, he would have trusted whomever he ran into. And it would have been like him that, yes, he had his money in his sock. Yep, that's exactly where he kept his money. And it would have been like him to flash his money in front of people, because he would never have stolen money from people. Why would people steal money from him? He was that trusting and perhaps naive. But that moment there was really an intense, special moment for me. And, you know, I'd felt like an outsider, and I had been intruding on the family. But they told me that night, hey, you're part of this now. This is your story as well as ours. And they eventually did meet Carol in person. They went, Joan and Bill McGonigal, they were on vacation 1 year back along the coast of North Carolina, and they went and met with Carol and had a really beautiful meeting with her. And Carol and I stayed connected for a few months, but then we lost track of each other for years. And it wasn't until like 2018 or so that I was feeling the need to resurrect this story and actually get it finished and published. And my nieces were a big driving force with that. I've told the story hundreds of times. As I mentioned in the book, I've told it on bar stools and over, you know, enchiladas and over, you know, and I've told it at family gatherings, and they would often say, Uncle Jim, will you tell the story about the boy in the woods? So one of those meetings, they really impressed upon me, you need to get this done. And I thought, you know what? Okay, let's do it. So in 2019, I got my brother, Tom, who is always up for an adventure. And we decided to go back to Merle's Inlet. And he said, you know, we really should bring one or a few of the McGonagalls with us. And Mike seemed to be a likely choice. So Mike agreed to go to Merle's Inlet with us in April of 2019. And so the three of us went to Merle's Inlet just to go back and, you know, tie up some loose ends if we could, revisit the sheriff's department. And a couple of, you know, a couple of folks there were very helpful, and revisited some of the people that I'd interviewed originally. And for Mike, he wanted to, you know, he wanted to tie some things up. You know, he had put a lot of this to rest already, but there were still some things I think he wanted some closure on. And one of the people that we visited, ended up visiting twice while we were there, was Chris Nance's mother.
Yes.
And the wife of Paul Nance, the first wife of Paul Nance, the drug dealing mafia boss in town. And Cynthia Nance is beautiful, just lovely, lovely, peaceful woman who clearly has processed a lot of the stuff that went on in her life. And she's at a real place of peace when we met her. And she was delightful. And she said, come in and sit down and let's talk. And I will tell you as much as I can and much as I'm willing to tell. And Mike McGonigal just wanted somebody in town to take some responsibility for what had happened, or point them in the direction of somebody that say something that would say, yes, that's how it happened. And eventually Cynthia got there and said, yeah, I could see that Paul, her ex-husband, had something to do with this crime, or the cleaning up of the crime scene, at least. And for Mike, that was enough. It was, that too was a very moving and poignant trip and visit for me.
Yes, this interaction between this 80-year-old woman, and she said, because Mike was confrontational somewhat, saying, listen, I think you're not telling us everything. I think you're lying. And then saying, you're not telling us everything. She said, listen, I know you deserve this. That's why I'm speaking to you. You deserve this kind of information. Yeah. And this is all the information I can speculate, but this is all the information I could give you. But it was very dramatic to say that this is certainly honest material that she's given you, or information, when she talks very candidly about the criminal life of her husband, Paul, and what she just didn't want to know.
Yes. Right. And, you know, like, you know, the spouse of someone who's involved in some nefarious things, there is a certain amount of turning your head the other way and not wanting to know. And there were many times, of course, he said to her, you don't need to know this. And for her, that was enough. And, you know, they had a very successful restaurant. He said it some nights they would run 400 to 600 people through there in the course of an evening. And they had a lot of money. And she said, I assumed it was most, you know, from the restaurant. Well, it was that and, you know, dealing cocaine and selling weed up and down the coast. And so there were a lot of things that went on that she did not know about. And I think legitimately. So she didn't, because she didn't want to know. As she said very candidly, and I thought beautifully, she said, I was ignorant to the point of stupid. And that's what I'm saying about her. The peace that I felt from her is that I think she's processed a lot of this, and it came to a place of peace with some of it. Like she said, she didn't know a lot of this stuff until after Paul died, but she suspects that, yeah, he was involved in, you know, roughing people up or worse, as she said at one point. You know, he had a group of thugs who worked for him, who would take care of business for him.
Yeah. So the likely scenario is that three people were involved, one person, as you explained. For the family, for the siblings, this trip, you said, was satisfying because he finally got some answers and somebody to say that at least it was a very good possibility.
Yes.
These people sustained themselves when they didn't have any answers for those 9 years, thinking that their loved one just left because of the treatment or other reasons. Maybe he was in a hospital. They knew he was having problems psychologically. Mm-hmm. So their faith sustained them through this, and the community that they had through their church and their pastor was always involved. And then Carol Williams becomes involved and talks about that there's no coincidences meeting you and
yes.
your involvement with this and your involvement with the family and growing up so near and saying that when Frank left, it affected your family as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You talk at the end of the book about visiting the gravesite that he was buried in because they didn't know who he was in Georgetown. Tell us about this very dramatic end and sort of that. Did you feel a presence and did Mike feel a presence?
Yes. So before we left, we went to visit Frank's grave. So in the meantime, so about five years after Frank died, the coroner in Georgetown, South Carolina, you know, they had this body that was in the morgue for 5 years and they needed to do something with it. So he had it buried in a marker that just said white male died June 1982. And so it was a John Doe grave. And then when the McGonagalls found out 9 years later about what had happened, they decided to leave Frank's body there, not to exhume him and bring him home, but just leave him in South Carolina and then put a marker on there. So they put, you know, another marker on there with Frank's name and birth date and all.
Right.
So we stopped by the cemetery on the way home and, before we left town, and Mike, it was just a poignant moment. I'm there with my brother and then, you know, Mike is there at the grave of his brother. And there was this moment where my brother came over and kind of put his hand on me, or I put my hand on him. I can't remember how that went down. And we're standing there, and then we're looking at Mike and thinking, wow, how is he connecting or feeling? And we didn't know what to say, really, but we all felt this presence and this connection to Frank and to brotherhood, really, you know, this bond of family. And so Mike says, hey, I've got something. I've been thinking about this moment. And he pulls his phone out and he scrolls through his phone and he calls up this app that he has. It's called ReListen. And it's got every Grateful Dead show that it was ever recorded, and most of them were, it's got them all. So he scrolls back to August of 1982, when one of his brothers, he and his brother, another brother, went to see the Grateful Dead in Kansas City. And it's called up Starlight Theater, Kansas City, Missouri, calls it up, and he scrolls over to this song, He's Gone. And he calls up the song, and he plays it. He sets his phone on the gravestone, and it's the song, He's Gone. And the lyrics are, he's gone, like a steam locomotive running down the track. He's gone, and he's never coming back. And he said when he was at that concert with his brother, Jerry, when they played that song, then just a couple months after Frank left home, they turned to each other, both of them in tears. And he said, we both knew at that time that Frank was dead. But we held out hope that maybe we were wrong and for the sake of their parents. But he said both of us knew. And so he played that song for us there in the cemetery. And man, it was intense and moving.
Another Grateful Dead song that was his favorite was Ripple.
Yes.
You've called this book Ripple. What's its significance, Ripple?
Yeah, so Frank, one of his favorite songs is Ripple, and same with the brothers. His brother Mark's a great musician, and he plays it frequently still. But, you know, and I think it was Mark, his brother Mark, who said to me one time, you know, Frank was a placid soul, you know, he was the still water. And he said, these guys came along and, you know, threw a pebble into our pond, into our placid life, and created ripples that, you know, reverberated far beyond, far beyond our family. But, and you never know the effects of your actions. But he said, I want these, you know, the people that were involved to know that what they did was, you know, cause some, you know, some intense ripples in our life. And later on, they found, well, we all discovered that three guys that they think were involved in this, Chris, Tommy, Jeff, are all dead now, and all died in some pretty heavy ways. Tommy went to prison, and actually he died shortly before I went, shortly before I got on the story. He died in prison of AIDS, which is an awful way to die. Chris was beaten to death with a 2x4 by his nephew and his nephew's roommate.
Wow.
Stabbed and set on fire. And Jeff McKenzie had a lot of health problems for many, many years, and then ended up dying of cancer in 2015, I believe. So everybody, all the guys involved in this are now gone. Paul, of course, is also dead.
Absolutely. I want to thank you so much for coming on and talking about Ripple, A Long, Strange Search for a Killer. Investigative author, Jim Cosgrove. You also, I mentioned earlier, you are the narrator, which is unusual, and it's great in this respect that you're the narrator for this audiobook as well. Tell us about the release and where people might see more information about this.
Yes. So the book is out on April 5th, and the book is available in either, you know, in a soft cover or audio, and it's available wherever you get books. I, of course, encourage everybody to order it through your local bookseller, because I am a big fan of local booksellers, and they will have access to it, and they can order it and they can get it in. You can get it on any platform where you get audiobooks as well.
Thank you so much, Jim Cosgrove, Ripple, A Long, Strange Search for a Killer. Thank you so much for this interview. You have a great evening.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Take care.
Thank you.